Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events. Here's Monty Larrick.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day. We're featuring highlights from Dr. Scott Lively's presentation during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference held at the Village Church of Barrington. Dr. Lively is an author, attorney, commentator, activist, and the founder and leader of Scott Lively Ministries.
I want to start out by giving my testimony so you can understand where I'm coming from. And then I want to go and talk generally about the issue of biblical masculinity, and we must play our role because things are so dire. I got my start. I was the oldest of six children in a Catholic family in Western Massachusetts. My dad was mentally ill, and by the time I got to be 9 or 10 years old, his mental illness had developed to a fairly high level. It got worse and worse. His mental illness was, they called it manic depressive at that time, but he also had psychosis during his manic phases. Very, very intense. His mental illness had apparently been in place his whole life, because when I was born, he developed an intense hostility toward me because I got in between him and my mother. And my mother paid attention to me, and he was very jealous, very angry. And I lived under that cloud of hostility my whole childhood. I was terrified of my father. He never physically touched me in any physical, you know, beating sense or whatever. But it was just the image that I had of my father, of him standing and glaring at me. When I got to be 12 years old, I discovered alcohol for the first time. My best friend, he was from an alcoholic family, and he had three older brothers that were wild and crazy, and he lived in big cities, and I had spent most of my life overprotected by my mom in the backyard. But anyway, I made a vow at 12 years old that I would live my life in such a way as to have good stories to tell. And whenever there were options of things to do, I would choose the one that would make the best story so I could tell that story without having to lie. And I've lived that way ever since. I'm 66 years old now. I have lived that entire time, and I have had the most incredible adventures all over the world as a guy who really never had much money. You know, the kind of lifestyle that I've lived, millionaires and multimillionaires can do that kind of stuff, you know, but just the Lord has just opened all kinds of doors. Well, my friend Ernie's uncle was a mobster in Boston. His best friend was killed in an alley with a 2x4. He told all kinds of stories about Boston and the mob. He bought us a 6-pack of Heineken beer, and we drank it behind the lake house in Ashfield, Massachusetts, and it was my first drunk. And I tell you, after I drank my third beer in that 6-pack, I was drunk at 12 years old. I thought, this is the answer, right? This is what life is about. And I wanted a vandalism spree. I threw some kid's tricycle in a brook, and then I tried to dump a bag of cement in a mailbox at a general store. This is a little country town. And the guy that owned the store lived up above, and he, instead of calling the police, he called my dad. I wish he had called the police. My dad finally had something he could get me on that my mom couldn't justify protecting me in. So he drove me home without a word. We got there. He got his sledgehammer out of the basement, took it up in my room, and he destroyed my room with a sledgehammer, starting with my prized television set that I bought with the proceeds of my paper route, my prized possession. They're standing there with glass all over the floor and sheetrock hanging down from the wall. I just screamed. That was the end of my childhood, and it was the beginning of a life of wandering all over. I was only 12 years old. You can't really do much at 12, but I treated my home life then, my house is just a crash pad, and I went out, and I still had to go to school. I got a hold of alcohol as often as I could from that point. I spent 16 years in bondage to alcohol and then drugs. A guy introduced me to marijuana as I was hitchhiking back from my first girlfriend's house, and I went further and further away as time went on. I ended up on the West Coast. I had all kinds of adventures in that lifestyle. You know, sin is pleasurable for a season, but after a while it begins to wear, and there's really nothing, you can't get out of it. If you're really an addict, you can't get out. I hitchhiked all over. This is back when you could still get away with it. You couldn't do it these days, but I was sort of like one of the last people that hitchhiked. I went all over the country, up and down and back and forth. I've been to all 50 states, been to 68 countries in my life. When you hitchhike back in those days, there were three types of people that would pick you up: alcoholics, homosexuals, and born-again Christians. I wanted to get picked up by the alcoholics because if they were feeling good enough to pick you up, they usually had a bottle in the car, they were on their way to a party or something like that. I really didn't want to get picked up by the homosexuals. More than once I had to fight my way out of a car. I didn't mind getting picked up by the Christians because they were usually pretty generous when it came time to get out of the car, and I would beg them for spare change. I lived under bridges, and I need to backtrack a little bit because I left out a big important chunk of the story that before I ended up on the road like this, but I will finish that story up. And that is that when I was almost 16, my dad had an armed standoff with the state police in the house that I grew up in over me having dropped out of school. He was in his manic phase. They were going to transfer me to a trade school, and I've been out of school for like a month. Nothing was happening, and I wasn't, you know, I liked not having to go to school. But he came and he got a hold of me and he sat me down and he said, "You're going to go back to Mohawk, the old school I'd been, and you're going to succeed because I'm going to help you." And that was the most terrifying thing that I could possibly imagine, my father taking charge of my life and forcing me to go back to a place where I had so many problems. And so the next morning, I stole a bottle of vodka from the liquor cabinet. I drank the whole thing at school, and the nurse, school nurse, found me wandering the halls completely drunk, called my mom, who took me to my grandmother's house, and then she went then back home and said, "Scott's not coming back." And he kicked her and the other and my five siblings out of the house, said, you don't come back until you bring him back. And then he barricaded himself in the house, and he had four guns and 600 rounds of ammunition, he reported to my friend. The next morning, when my friend Ernie and I, he came over with me, he was going to go in my house and get my record albums. Now, that's the thing we had before CDs and all you kids. My dad came to the door completely naked with a shotgun in his hand. He said, "I kicked Judy out of the house and blah, blah, blah. I got four guns and 600 rounds of ammunition." And then that was reported to me. I watched the whole thing from across the street. The state police shot the house full of tear gas. He was in it for a long time. I don't know how. He was manic, so it didn't faze him. And in the end, though, they convinced him to leave because of the animals, of our house pets. And on the basis of that, he came out. He took him away. He spent the rest of his life in the state mental hospital. My mom divorced him. She had to move into a smaller house with the other five kids. There was literally no room for me. And at the age of 16, I was on my own. I was living on the streets. The special ed teacher at this high school that I had gone to got me into a special program, a hippie free school, which actually turned out to be one of the most interesting experiences of my life. And I was able to graduate from high school, getting credits, doing things like being an apprentice at the local newspaper. That was my life. That was my early life. And when that was over, I was hitchhiking all over the country, and these three categories of people would pick me up. And like I said, I didn't mind getting picked up by the Christians because they were generous with the spare change. But I would always have to listen to their spiel, right? They'd see my life, and they'd say, "You know, look, if you want to change your life, just ask Jesus to come into your heart, and he will change your life." You know, I was raised Catholic, so I knew about God. I didn't know much about Jesus. The big thing for me was, first, that sounds too much like a magic trick, right? Abracadabra and everything's going to be fine. No, it can't be true. It can't be true. But even more than that, I thought, you know, if I become a Christian, I'm not going to be able to drink or take drugs anymore. And how in the world am I ever going to deal with the pain of life? And so I didn't do it. And I tried everything else. I got involved with Scientology. I got involved around the edges with the Moonies. I got involved with a crazy hippie commune called the Brotherhood of the Spirit. I read self-help books. I tried everything that you could think of to get out, and it would always last for a couple weeks, and then I would fall back. I was in desperation. I was married by this time. I got married to my wife, and we had two children together. She was the head of the household. She had a good job. I couldn't hold a job. I had a handyman service. I couldn't last doing anything any length of time. The story of how we met is part of my testimony to. This segues into the whole thing about masculinity. This lifestyle that I was living, there was no hope in it. I didn't care about my life. I didn't want to die, but I didn't do anything really to preserve my life. Every time I hitchhiked, I was putting my life on the line. There was no purpose. There was no meaning in life. I didn't have a model of a father. I didn't know what it meant to be a man. I certainly wasn't going to be like him, and I just had fallen into this sort of despair. Nothing worked, and the last thing that I tried was to go out and live in the woods, just dry out in the woods. I was a pothead. My drug of choice was marijuana, and I smoked mountains of weed. I took other drugs when I could get them, but when you have no money, when you're living really cheap, you know, it's booze and it's pot. That's about what you could get. And I did both as often as much as I could. But I was really a pothead, and I had a pothead mind. And I thought, I'm going to go live out in the woods, and I'm going to get cleaned up. So I had this old, ripped-up canvas rucksack. I bought a couple of bags of brown rice. I got a couple of books on how to live off the land, and like one change of clothes. I looked on a map. Where is the densest forest in Oregon? I was living in Oregon, on the coast. And so I took a bus there. I got off the bus with no idea. I looked to see which side of town looked the most rural. And then I just walked off into the woods with no plan and was going to just go live. Somehow I was going to get clean. I brought a book. One reading book was Walden Pond, right? Henry David Thoreau, who was famous for living, being a naturalist and all that. And so I'm reading Walden Pond, and in the book, Thoreau is being chastised by his friends. He's the son of a pencil factory owner. He's a man of means, really. He wasn't a poor guy. And his friends were saying, how come you're not taking care of widows and orphans? And he felt, shamed by that. And so he found a woman who was a widow, and he began providing for her financially. Here I am sitting in there, and I'm going, you know what? I have nothing to live for. But this sounds like that's what I could do. I could find a family, and this is what it comes to, sort of innate masculinity, right? That's sort of inside you as a male that comes out naturally, even when you're Scott Lively, the pothead, living this sort of tragic comic experience. This impulse sort of comes up. I've got nothing to live for, but I will find somebody that needs help. I'll find a family that needs help, and I will live for them. I wasn't a Christian, but that was the impulse. I think that's why God had me there in that place at that time. And after I had that sort of epiphany, that sort of resolution, I got up, I went down, I worked in a Kentucky Fried Chicken for a month, and then I went back to Portland. Around the corner to the block that I live on, there's a beautiful three-story Victorian gingerbread house. And this beautiful woman standing in the front yard up on a little hillock with grass about this tall, a little bit wet, standing there trying to mow it with this rusty old push mower, crying, damsel in distress. And so I went up and said, can I help you with that? I grabbed the mower. You can't mow the lawn with this. It's sort of like, what's going on with this woman's mind, right? It's like, impossible. I said, don't you have a power mower? And she said, it's broken. So I said, well, let me take a look at it. And I'm thinking, this woman really needs someone to take care of her. But that was the impulse. And the Lord connected. And so I had survival skills like you couldn't believe. I was a real survivor. I could accomplish all kinds of things. So I got her lawnmower fixed for her. And I brought it back to her. And that evening, I went to her front door. And I asked her if she wanted to go out walking. And she said yes. And we took a walk up to the Rose Garden in Portland and fell in love with each other on the walk. And we got married after a while. And you know what? I didn't know till much later that was the first day she had ever prayed to Jesus. First day she had ever prayed to Jesus. And she specifically prayed for a man to rescue her. Talk about the miracles of God. She prayed for a man to rescue her because her ex-husband, her violent ex-husband that she had just broken free from, was still around, stalking her, coming around the house at night, looking through the windows. Because she had prayed that prayer, she was open to seeing me as a rescuer, and I did rescue her, right? I came right off the sidewalk, and I rescued her and solved the problem for her, and I guess that convinced, and she's now my wife. We'll be celebrating 43 years of marriage. And I learned really for the first time what it meant to be a masculine man. And I learned in this process, I mean, I still wasn't together yet. I still was alcoholic and a drug addict. But see, Anne had skills at life. She could manage day-to-day life. She was very good. She's a master's in anthropology from the University of Chicago. She's very, very smart, multilingual, very intellectual, very skilled. I had nothing but survival skills, but that's what she needed. And I needed what she had. It was God put it together perfectly. But he taught me masculinity in the process of that, that something came out of me that I didn't know was there. It's innate. God has built into us as men the fact that we are men, with the characteristics of masculinity that are there, that are just part of the way he designed us to be. And I began to learn that at that time. You know, to whom much is given, much is required. Right? That's what the scripture tells us. And so now I finally have a life that's worth living, and I'm devoted. She has two sons from this previous marriage, but as time goes on, we do have two kids of our own. But it came to a place where I was going to lose my family because of my drinking.
Dr. Scott Lively, during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference. More of his remarks from that special event after this.
With a woman to look at culture from a Christian worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. According to new data recently shared by Dr. Ryan Burge, the number of people who are currently evangelical has now dropped below the number of people who were raised evangelical. In other words, more people are leaving evangelicalism than are remaining or becoming evangelical. This shift started about 15 years ago. After all, evangelicalism has always been a growth movement with more people in it than were raised in it. In other words, from about 1900 till 2010, evangelicals were living up to their names. They were evangelizing. However, between the ex-evangelical movement and the declining regard for Christianity, some evangelicals now lack the confidence that they really have what the world needs. For others, the good news of the gospel has been crowded out by weeds of doubt and distraction. The gospel is news. It has to be shared and lived with clarity, confidence, and courage. For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street.
Thanks for joining Illinois Family Spotlight. We're featuring remarks made by Dr. Scott Lively during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference held at the Village Church of Barrington. The founder and leader of Scott Lively Ministries is an author, attorney, commentator, and activist.
I had gotten a drunk driving ticket, this one part I'll tell you, and I had been given the choice of diversion instead of going to jail. Go to treatment, and I've been putting off for as long as I could, and I was going to AA. When you go to AA, they tell you, if you don't believe you're an alcoholic, then go out and take a drink, and you'll find out. And I thought, you know, I'd heard that over and over again, and I was getting really dry, and I thought, you know, what a great idea. I can get drunk, and I can blame it on AA. And so that's what I did. I went home that day. I bought a couple of 16-ounce cans of beer. I went home and popped them open. I drank the first one down, standing there. She's off working. I've got the house to myself. I drank it, and as the first one, you start to feel the alcohol take effect. All of a sudden, it was like a ton of bricks. I really am an alcoholic. I really am an alcoholic. And then instantly, like this tsunami comes in, I've just destroyed my family. And it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. I remembered what all those Christians had told me along the way. And I knew this was the end for me. This was the bottom. There was no deeper place to go. And I just leaned up against the sink and I looked up at the ceiling. I remember it clear as day, like it was yesterday. And I said, Jesus, I don't know if you're real, but if you are, I ask you to come into my heart and change my life. You know, within 2 weeks, through a series of miracles, I ended up in a secular alcohol and drug rehab center, where on the third day that I was in there, I got down on my knees and I surrendered my life to Jesus Christ completely and totally. Hallelujah. And I was delivered and healed instantly, miraculously, never had another desire to take drugs or drink ever again. Ever again. Not even a whisper. And I was a guy, I couldn't go 4 hours without getting high. I would go into the city parks and just ask random strangers, do you know where I can buy drugs, right? And that was my life. But now, all of a sudden, he had removed it completely. It was like the Holy Spirit came through me like a rushing wind. And when I stood up, I was completely and totally healed by surrender to Christ. From that point, that's when things really started to get interesting in my life, because I turned my life over to Christ, and he said, okay, I'm going to use it. I'm going to use you for my service. I said, to whom much is given, much is required. You don't go through the kind of experiences that I'd gone through for nothing. Everything that happens is for God's purposes when you love him and decide that your life is for his purpose, right? Romans 8:28. He will make all things to your good. He'll turn them all to your good if, conditional, you love him and are called according to his purpose. And that's where I was at. And all of a sudden, boom, these incredible changes came in. Within just a few months, well, first he sort of taught me how to be a man. He taught me how to take care of my family. Step by step, I went from being just doing handyman stuff to actually having a building trades collective, that really a one call does it all thing. And all these talents and skills started coming out that were from him. And then I got involved in becoming a Christian social activist, standing against the killing of the unborn. So I read this scripture, it's 2 Timothy 4:1-5, Paul's admonition to Timothy to make the best of use of your life as an evangelist. Reprove, rebuke, and exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. It's God's commissioning of me, which I didn't get, right? He kept bringing it back to mind over the next week or 2 weeks, you know, over and over again. Then all of a sudden I realized, oh, were you talking to me? Oh! I became a full-time Christian social activist, and from that I went to law school. I became an attorney, graduated magna cum laude from Trinity Law School in Southern California. I then went from there and got a Doctor of Theology degree from the Pentecostal Assemblies of God. I got a Certificate in International Human Rights from the University of Strasbourg in France. And it goes on and on and on and on. Incredible adventures all over the world, all because I surrendered my life to Christ. All because of that. And in that process, I learned about masculinity. And I learned about masculinity, biblical masculinity, where a man stands for the truth of God. Man of La Mancha, there's a song that Brian Stokes Mitchell does, The Impossible Dream. And he's basically the Don Quixote figure. He sings this song about, it's the duty of every true knight to live a life of service, right? And there's this line in that says, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. I've had that sense about my life this whole time because, like I said, to whom much is given, much is required. And when you've been through the kinds of things that I've been through, and nothing in your life is wasted either. It's all for preparation. And through all of this, this drew upon masculinity in me that I didn't know I had. A man stands up for the truth. A Christian man stands for the truth. And he does so regardless of the consequences because he's standing for the truth of God. Just like all the prophets and all the martyrs in the church all the way back. That's what it means to be a Christian man who is in service to God. You give your life to him, and then he sends you out into battle, and he provides for you. And like Job said, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. And I proved God so many times over and over again where he got me out of every kind of struggle and difficulty and attack that you can imagine. But I became essentially a missionary to the global pro-family movement as an act of masculinity. One of the most significant acts of being a man and of taking responsibility, I'm not bragging on myself, I'm bragging on him. There's no good thing in me. There's nothing in me that doesn't come from him. So every time when I speak and it sounds like, oh, Scott Lively's talking about himself, well, I am talking in a testimonial style, but everything good thing that you hear is from him. And he can do the same thing for anyone else here. If you surrender your life to the extent, completely, whatever you hold back, you're going to create a barrier that he's going to have to get around. He's going to have to deal with you on whatever it is you aren't going to submit. Like I tell people, you know, behold, I stand at the door and knock. right? Anyone who answers the door, I'll come in and dine with them. But Jesus says that. That's what's happening. Really, what evangelism is, really? Evangelism is just persuading people to answer the knock on the door. You can't save anybody. You can't save anybody. Jesus saves people, and he saves them by coming into their life. But when he comes into your life through that door, he's not going to be an intruder. He's not going to go poking around in the rooms that you don't invite him in. When you surrender your life, if you want to have the kind of life where he will really use you in a powerful way, you have to give him control of all of it, every bit of it. You let him have access to every nook and cranny. He knows it's there anyway. You're not hiding anything from God. But when you do surrender all that, he takes management of it, and he makes something worthwhile out of something that you were going to mess up again, right? You're going to mess up anyway. That's what the difference was. I've had lots and lots of people over the course of my life that have been in various types of recovery. They've gone back over and over again to rehabs. And the difference is, you know, the place that I went to is a secular rehab center. They called me a year after. I was the only person that was still clean and sober a year later, the only one. It was because it wasn't anything they did, it was because of him. He delivered me. It was miraculous. And my final word basically is to challenge every man in this room and every woman who wants a man to be a masculine Christian. The most masculine thing you can do is to surrender your life, to surrender completely to Jesus Christ, because he wants you to be. He has a life for you, a manly life that's beyond anything that you can imagine, as long as you're willing to stand firm. The devil can't take any ground from you. He can scare you. He tries to get you to back up, to give up the territory so he can step in. He can't take it if you don't give it up. So on everything where biblical truth is important, stand on that truth. Don't surrender the territory. God will bless you for it, and people like me will thank you. So God bless you.
Dr. Scott Lively, during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Recovering Biblical Manhood Worldview Conference at the Village Church of Barrington. You can connect with his ministry at scottlively.net. Please support the work of the Illinois Family Institute. All donations are tax deductible. To give, click Donate on the IllinoisFamily.org homepage or call IFI 708-781-9328. And visit IllinoisFamily.org for IFI resources to find out about upcoming events and to sign on for IFI email updates. Please tell your family and friends about Illinois Family Spotlight. Until next time, stay healthy, stay active, and God bless.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.